Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt, and we're brought to you by Ironman U. Run Catalina.com, Catalina Island Conservancy Marathon coming up on Saturday, March 19th. EveryPsych.com and our Challenged Athletes Foundation. We've raised over $70 million to help 11,000 people stay in the game of life through sport. And you can check out any of our interviews on Babbittville.com or on iTunes. We've had over 700,000 downloads. Our next guest, one of our favorite people. Go back a lot of years with Susie Favor Hamilton. She, well, let's talk 11 high school state titles, 9 NCAA titles, 7 USATF championships, 3 Olympic teams. Susie Favor Hamilton, how the heck are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, no problem, Susie. It's been a long time. I think the last time we chatted, we talked about roller coasters and your love of traveling around the country and doing all the cool roller coasters there were.
You have a great memory.
So talk about growing up. When did you realize that running was going to be your ticket to success?
You know, I learned at quite an early age. I just remember as a little girl running around the woods near my parents' house and pretending to be a horse. And it felt so effortless.
And what's intriguing to me is when you started racing, I'm guessing that you had success right away?
Yes, I did. I mean, right away. Fifth grade, I was already, you know, beating the boys and showing that talent.
From interviewing Mary Decker Slaney and Ruth Wysocki and a lot of the top women from over the years, it seems that a lot of times they grew up in a little bit of a vacuum because they're so dominant. They're so much better than everybody else that it takes until they're even sometimes out of high school before they run into competition where there's all of a sudden somebody who can potentially challenge them. Was that similar for you?
Absolutely. You know, growing up in Wisconsin, in the Midwest, in the cold winters, I didn't feel like I had enormous competition. There were a couple girls every year. My best friend, Mary Hartsheim, was a really good runner. She challenged me. But like you said, you know, growing up, there wasn't a ton of competition. And then when you make that jump, it can be a bit of a shock.
Yeah, because it's funny. I talked to different guys about this as well. And some of the guys are like, listen, we've been competitive with everybody from, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8. There's always somebody who's better.
Right.
And a lot of times when you grow up in that vacuum where there's you are it, it becomes tough when all of a sudden there's another it and there's somebody who can challenge you. Was that hard for you to deal with?
It was really hard because I felt, well, especially when I was in high school, I would make these junior world teams and I would compete overseas, which was mind-blowing. That I would go into these races and I would come out maybe eighth place.
Right.
And I would go back to the States and people would be like, you got eighth place. Oh, my gosh. You know, they were disappointed.
Yeah.
What happened? You must have had the worst race of your life. When now you just ran the fastest time you've ever run. So that was really hard for me to deal with because I couldn't sit there and explain this to every person who stopped me. And said, oh, I'm so sorry you had a bad race.
Because the reality is you just ran faster than you ever had in your life. And you're expecting an attaboy for, oh, my God, you're running faster than ever, rather than a, what happened? We're disappointed. Aren't you disappointed?
And I learned early on about, I remember this particular race we were in Romania running. And I remember these girls beating me literally by 75 yards in the mile and thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, what's wrong with me? You know, I didn't understand drugs at that time.
Right.
I didn't know young girls are being supplied drugs in high school. You know, it was such a foreign concept to me. I just thought something's wrong with me. I'm not good enough.
I'm guessing that what you, I mean, you talk about running through the woods and being like a horse and just, and feeling like, God, I love this. Then all of a sudden the competition side starts. Did you ever like the racing, or did you love the training and just running more?
I loved, I would say I liked the training a lot because of the feeling it gave me every day.
Yeah.
Racing became, in the big races, it became so much pressure. And like I said, it brought these insecurities out in me that were in the States. I was good.
Yeah.
But when in these other countries, all of a sudden, I'm not good enough. And I'm a failure. And everybody is telling me, why aren't you winning? And I'm seeing other runners, young runners who are on the U.S. team, it was the sprinters that were dominating. And always in my mind, why can't I be one of those people to bring home a medal?
Right.
And be able to celebrate like all these other athletes, just feeling not whole, just, you know, empty inside, leaving those competitions.
Well, so it sounds like so much of your identity was so tied to running. It wasn't, you couldn't be one without the others. Susie Favre Hamilton runner was who you were, and it doesn't sound like there was, you had a sense of yourself not as a runner.
Right, and the thing is about that, yeah, absolutely. My identity was wrapped up into my running, but it was me who created that identity.
Right. Right.
You know, it's, we do that to ourselves.
And we put our own pressure on, but still, the messages you're getting when you're coming back from international is, it's not good enough. You're not good enough.
And you're getting the reinforcement from the people around you telling that.
Right. That, hey, if you want to be an Olympian, you've got to beat these people, and it doesn't matter what you've done before. So, I mean, the reality, you should have been reveling in the fact that you won 9 NCAA titles, and they changed the name of the award, right? The Big Ten, it became the Susie Favre Hamilton Award because of your domination.
Right.
I mean,
which has been taken away now.
Right. I know. How hard was that when they took that away?
You know, at the time when I was exposed for being the escort in Vegas,
yeah,
this happened, you know, fairly quickly. But at that time, my world was so devastated that at the time was kind of a slap on the face, like, right. Oh, great, now somebody's just going to kick me,
yeah,
and bring me down even further. So it wasn't horrible, but it was a blow in that, oh, my God, these people don't even want to hear what has happened in my life. And basically, my husband, I was diagnosed as bipolar at that time.
Yeah.
He had sent the Big Ten an email saying, please, you know, I know that you're probably going to take the award away, but I would really like to explain this. Susie's been diagnosed with a mental illness. Can you just hold off? And the email back from the commissioner, who was a very good supporter and friend of mine, basically in his email said, good luck. Good luck to your family. End of story.
Wow.
I didn't want to hear. That was the hardest part. It wasn't so much that the award was taken away. It was the way it was handled. And, you know, so many other athletes have done things in their careers. You know, I don't want to name athletes.
Sure.
Have done really bad things that have hurt others. I was never intentionally trying to hurt anybody. But they've actually hurt people, caused harm to them. Their awards are still there. They're, you know, nothing has been done.
Right.
They've done a bigger, you know, and in some cases it's been criminal.
So, Susie, talk a little bit about your brother Dan, and when you realized that he had some issues.
It was early on. Back then, mental illness was more described as you're crazy.
Right.
That was the stigma around it, and it still is there. You know, where people don't want to. You know, they should not be labeled as crazy. It's a chemical imbalance in the brain. This is real. But back then, I knew nothing about a chemical imbalance. I just thought, why can't my brother be good? Why does he have to create so much chaos in this family? Why did he just drink that whole bottle of vodka and is passed out on the floor with a shotgun in his arms? I was seeing.
Oh, my God. So you saw all that?
Yeah.
How old were you?
I remember, I think, the shotgun incident. I must have been around 11 or 12.
And did your parents talk about it? Did they bring everybody together? And 'cause I'm assuming that parents really didn't know how to deal with this at all back then either.
They didn't. You know, there wasn't the counseling that there is today, the family support. I mean, there's family counseling on how to help people deal with a loved one with mental illness. That wasn't there. We didn't have Twitter to have people discussing this and, you know, self-help groups. It was a different world. It was a Brady Bunch world where you posed for the family picture and you looked perfect. And everybody had the perfect family pictures up on their mantle and their wall portraying perfection, which doesn't exist in any family.
So as you're going along in your career and you make your first Olympic team, and that's the ultimate goal for a runner. You make your Olympic team in 92.
Yes.
What were your thoughts going into that Olympics? And when you go into your first Olympics, you're just sort of happy to be there.
Right. Oh, I was, here it is, my dream. I have worked my entire life to make this team. It was overwhelming that day, you know, when I crossed the finish line and I came in third and I beat my idol. I was just overjoyed. You can't even come up with that word. So making that was awesome, but yet after that it's short-lived because now the pressure began, okay, she's going to win the gold. My hometown had, banners up, and everybody in my hometown assumed I was going to make the gold medal.
Right.
Made the Olympic. They have no idea how the running world works.
Of course not.
Yeah. So now this pressure is building up. My sponsor, Reebok, was very invested in me
and
my career. I had profit sharing in the company. I was just, there was a lot of pressure.
Well, you were, everybody thought you were going to sign with Nike.
Right.
That was a natural. And
right.
I think it was at an indoor track meet where, I mean, it must have been right before that where you signed with Reebok. And for the rumors I had heard, Phil Knight was watching on television as Susie Favre Hamilton came running on the track in Reebok. And he was just like, what just happened here? And I think some people lost their jobs because...
They did. There were some jobs lost. You know, it was amazing looking back. I remember when Nike was recruiting me and they came to the University of Wisconsin. The guy, I can't even remember his name. It doesn't matter. But he tried to lure me to work with Nike because the clothes and the shoes were so exceptional.
Right.
He just sold me on, he thought, this is a young girl. She's going to want to wear our product. And when Reebok stepped in, honestly, their shoes were not good at
that. No. Well, they needed you. They needed credibility.
And they knew their shoes weren't good. They wanted to improve. Obviously, their shoes did very well, and they've improved dramatically. But... they didn't sell me on their product because they knew
that wasn't going to work.
Yeah, but they made some big promises, and they said, you know what, we're going to make you a star. We're going to give you a commercial. We're going to give you the profit sharing in the company. We're going to, do all these great things, which they did.
Yes, they were a partner. You guys were partners to grow Reebok.
Right.
Where Nike, at that point, wasn't going to do that with you.
No, I just was going to be another athlete,
right.
And I never was going to get any spotlight from them because of, so many big names that Nike had already. It was going to be hard to compete.
But if you think about it, if I'm Reebok and I'm trying to make a name for myself, here you are, an Olympian in 92, an Olympian again in 96. From my perspective, it doesn't really matter how you – just the fact you get to the games is good enough. They can build their commercials around getting the – because the games themselves are a crapshoot. You never know who's going to win what, but it's – think about the Dan and Dave thing. They invested much in that.
Happens. Yeah.
You're right. They invested so much in that, and then Dan doesn't even make the team.
Right.
So the reality is
– This is life. It's not fair. And these things happen all the time.
Did you now, when you were not having success in the Olympics, were people actually saying to you, "Gosh, Susie, you've disappointed us," or was it you were putting that pressure on yourself?
I think, you know, I think at that time people were probably, in the running world, were realistic and saying, you know, it's her first one. She doesn't have the international experience yet. She's
right.
Young. But in my mind, complete failure. After that race that I bombed in 92, I just wanted to vanish. I didn't want, I felt like everybody was staring at me, this paranoia. I believe that's part of my illness, where you feel like the world is just watching you. Everybody
right.
on the street is staring at you saying, oh, she's the one that failed. She's the one that was, you know, supposed to do really well. Even in the village, I remember after the race, walking through the village, feeling like all these athletes are staring at me and I'm the worst person in the world.
Was there a point, a lot of times I looked at you as similar to an Anna Kournikova, who people, you're beautiful. You're a beautiful young woman, and you're a runner, which is a rare combination. And Anna Kournikova was a beautiful young woman who was a tennis player. And people were like, well, she's not living. She's getting endorsements because she's beautiful rather than because she's a tennis player. And basically the same type of thing for you. She's gotten Reebok because she's beautiful, not because she's a great runner. Was that part of something that you could sense from the public and from your competition?
Absolutely, because there was an article written on me. I forgot who did it, if it was the Chicago Tribune or somebody who wrote this article comparing me to her. And it at that time, I felt like, oh, my gosh, I need to improve. They're almost making a joke out of me.
Right.
In hindsight, if I would have taken the route of being more the model who runs, I would have been happier.
Exactly.
If the pressure would have been taken off.
Yeah. No expectations. It's like, listen,
one
thing that I heard over time from a sports agent, actually a sports agent named Murphy Reinschreiber, who represented Paula Newby Frazier.
Okay.
It's great Ironman champion.
And I remember her very well.
Okay. That was Paula. And then it was Aaron Baker, who was another great champion. And Paula had more endorsements than Aaron did. And both of them were great athletes. And I asked Murphy, I said, Murph, so why does Paula have so many more endorsements than Aaron? He goes, as an athlete, the only thing you're entitled to is the prize money that comes with racing. Anything else you get, your looks, your personality, in this day and age, your social media outreach, that's dependent on everything else you bring to the table. And that has nothing to do, and it's connected a little bit with if you win or lose, but not really. In your case, you could certainly make the argument that you were, people noticed you. You made three Olympic teams. You certainly were an incredibly successful athlete, but in your mind, that wasn't enough.
Right. And, you know, my first Olympic team, when I look back on that, and I was living in Malibu, and I was starting to do some auditions for commercials and doing modeling for magazines, I loved it. I thought, oh, my God, this is so great. It's fun, and it's nothing like training really hard. It's easy. I mean, getting up there and smiling, this is easy compared to busting my butt out on the track. But I couldn't speak up about that because I knew what everybody would say. And I knew my husband would say the exact same thing, and he's admitted to me, he would have told me that if I did go that route, I was wasting my talent.
Right.
So that wasn't an option.
Gotcha. Hey, I still have somewhere in my house, I still have my Susie Favor Hamilton calendar.
Right.
From back in the day.
Right, right. Which was a lot of fun.
I bet you had a lot of horses and, you know, on the beach, all sorts of cool stuff. So 11th in the qualifying round in 92, in 4th in 96. Right?
It's funny because you say, I have no idea. If somebody asked me what place I got at the Olympics, I'd be like, I have no clue.
So, but when you go into 2000, and what I don't think people realized, and I had, to be honest, I had no idea your brother had committed suicide.
Right.
And he only committed suicide a year before. When he did commit suicide, obviously you're running. You're got the Olympics. So you're able to dive right back into a focus. But did the family ever get together and go, we need to grieve. We need to grieve as a family. We just lost a son and a brother.
My family definitely grieved, and I didn't. I went on to train. I mean, after the funeral, there's a reception. I went to the reception, and I literally left the reception early because I had to get on a plane to go to Ireland to start rehab on my injury.
Yeah. Wow.
And I did not grieve at all. I just held it in. Like every problem I had had in my life, I tucked it away in my brain and didn't release it. It just, it was a building of layers. And I thought, I'm strong, I'm tough, oh, I can handle this. What a, you know, not a big deal. I never knew those layers at some time in your life will explode if you don't learn how to release them.
Did, knowing that your brother had mental illness, did you go in and see anybody to say, you know what, I'm part of a family that has mental illness, a little bit of a history here, go in for, you didn't go for a diagnosis or anything?
No, I think, you know, there was an instance in my book, I write about this instance where I'm actually babysitting. I leave the babysitting house while I'm babysitting. I just leave. The baby's in the crib. I have a race the next day. The babysitter isn't home on time. I literally leave the house and sleep run. I'm asleep or in a... There's some word for it.
Right. You're in a certain state, basically.
If you're awake, your eyes are open,
right.
But really I wasn't there. And I literally ran home so fast. It must have been so fast because I don't even remember the running. I remember as I got closer being more aware of where I was. But I believe after that incident, my father suggested that I go see a psychologist.
Right.
Okay. And I remember saying, no way. That's for crazy people like my brother. There's absolutely no way. Being so naive and, you know, the stigma. And I believe the word stigma should be shame. Feeling that that would be shame. I would be considered a lesser person to
admit.
Yeah, to admit or go see a doctor. That isn't a strong, powerful woman, I thought.
Right. Well, and I think that was the general perception at that time.
Right.
If you go and admit that. Yeah. So in the 1500 finals in 2000, second best qualifying time going in, people again are talking, we're talking medal, right? Talking gold medal. And you had some, I think it was it 97 or so? You had some injuries. You went back to your original running coach, your high school coach, and got, something like you got your mojo back, correct?
Right. I was, because in 96 I was in Eugene training, and
yeah.
I was feeling that the coach at the time was just too possessive over me.
Right.
Like very possessive in a way that I was not healthy. And my best friend was Mary at the time noticed this and said, this is not right. Something is wrong with this. And she told Mark, my husband, that she thought I should leave this coach. And then Mark had told me what Mary said. And basically, she was a mentor of mine. And I was like, you're right. This isn't good. And that's why I went back to Wisconsin. And then my performance improved dramatically.
Well, because that way you were with somebody who cared about you. You were with somebody you could trust. You're with somebody and not dealing with a lot of other personalities.
Yes. And he was, he's not coaching anymore, just an exceptional coach. Wherever he went, he brought success. He coached at Stanford after his career at Wisconsin and won every year the national championship. I mean, just an amazing talent for a coach.
So in 2000 in the finals, when you collapsed towards the end and then later admit that you collapsed on purpose,
right.
I always wondered, why tell anybody? I mean, okay, people collapse all the time. It happens. And I'm sure that a number of the people who have collapsed in the past just looked at it as maybe it wasn't totally conscious, but to a certain degree, it's sort of a not a bad way to go out. Okay, I cramped, I passed out. Why go public?
I think probably at the time, there's so many things I'm still trying to figure out.
Right.
I think, you know, by talking about it, maybe there was a part of me that was trying to reach out and say, you know what, I'm not perfect. I have faults. Can society accept this in me? I think maybe I was testing the water a little bit. And, you know, talking about that, my depression, what we thought was depression, I wanted to maybe get that out, that I wasn't as perfect as everybody thought.
That, again, goes back to the fact you had so much success so young, and, you know, back to the Mary Slaney connection as well. That becomes tough when you're when you've had that much success, and in this particular case, not just success, but you've had commercial success as well. Is there something in your mind that says, I don't deserve this?
You know, I really wanted it, so I don't know if that's accurate.
Yeah.
Because I really wanted, I wanted to win.
Right.
I wanted to please. But I don't feel like I said to myself, I don't deserve it. I felt that there was so much in the sport that wasn't fair. Obviously, you learn in life, like I said earlier, that life isn't fair.
Exactly.
But during that time, it was so frustrating to be in a world that, you know, it was so out of my control. And, you know, I hate to always go back to the drugs, but the drug use in the sport of track and field and in all sports wherever there's money involved is horrendous. It's
yes.
awful. And to compete against that and the hard work you put in day after day, to have that taken away by somebody who's just shown up on the line, you've never even heard of this person, and they win the gold medal.
Well, not only that, I've interviewed a number of cyclists over the years who were in that era when drugs were so prevalent in cycling. And someone like an Andy Hampston, who was one of the best, and he was forced to retire because he couldn't compete anymore. So he had to make a decision. Do I go to the dark side, or do I figure I'm just going to wrap up my career? But the when you're competing against people who you know deep down are dirty, it affects you because you realize that I can't get where they're at because it's not real, but I'm still feeling awful and I can't tell other people. I have to keep that inside. I can't tell other people that I'm being cheated or it looks like I'm whining.
You're sour grapes.
Yes.
Yeah, because you aren't winning and these people are winning. You're just complaining. Get out there and train harder, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Is what you're going to have written up about you. It's amazing because I look at young girls today and I look at their parents that are amazingly out of perspective, the parents who are pushing their children to be these runners at such early ages and these young girls running marathons. It's absolutely ludicrous. And I want to say to them, you know what? The chances of winning a gold medal are so slim that if you're they're going to have to choose that dark side in order to make that happen. And I hate to have to say that and be the one, but, I mean, really, to win that gold medal, the chances are it could happen if the race goes the perfect way where it's strategic and somebody's running incredibly smart. That absolutely could happen.
Oh, yeah, but if you're dealing with a race that's once every 4 years.
Right.
The odds, we've both seen a lot of people who have great seasons in that build-up to the Olympics, and then all of a sudden, Olympic year, they have injuries, they're sick, whatever it happens to be. The odds on somebody getting to the starting line of their final in the best shape of their life, ready to win the gold, that's a crapshoot, big-time crapshoot.
Yeah, you might as well pick out of a hat.
Exactly. So after the Olympics is in 2000, and is that when your brother's loss, when you had time to reflect, you reflect on your Olympics, you reflect on your loss of your brother? I'm sure at this time, because you're not focused on getting to the Olympics, it's over. Is that when it all hit?
You know, it was even later.
Really?
Matt, I think my best friend, she had died shortly after my baby was born in 2005.
Yeah.
And I think after her death, I started to grieve my brother more and realize how I had put that away.
You put it on the back burner.
Yeah, I didn't want to deal with it. And that's when it really hit me.
So much of your life was running when your professional career was over. Was that hard, or was it nice not to be in the spotlight?
I loved it.
You loved it. You see, that way you could just run, enjoy it, and not feel any pressure.
Yeah, and I could walk. I could go for two-hour walks. I remember when I was training really hard thinking, if I could just walk right now, wouldn't that be so much more enjoyable?
All of us feel that.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Well, now I had that opportunity to be that person who could literally walk for 2 hours, and I just loved it. It was, I didn't have to feel pain anymore. So I had that period where I was happy that the running was done, but yet at the same time, something was changing in me mentally. The drug that I was taking for my brain, which was running,
was gone.
Right, yeah.
So,
but I didn't want to train.
Right, you didn't want to train, but there's something about those endorphins that just are, you know, talk about an addiction.
Right.
That's the ultimate. 2005, you had your little girl. And that gives you a chance to focus on somebody else for a change and to focus on being a mom and not a professional runner. Did you really enjoy that period?
I enjoyed the birth of my daughter so much. That was the best day of my life, is giving birth to her.
Yeah.
It was amazing. I had this new feeling about life that my running was so insignificant. It had already taken the back burner, but now it seems so, so tiny in the scheme of my life. But having a child, I changed. And mentally, something happened with the hormones in me. And I just was so overwhelmed at being a mother. Everything overwhelmed me. And I struggled immensely.
When did you feel that, okay, I've got an issue and I've got to deal with it?
I think it's very easy to deny and say, mm-hmm. Tomorrow I'm going to be fine.
Right.
A year goes by. Well, then tomorrow I'm going to be fine. And it's easy to just, you know, ignore this and not have to deal with it. But it did get to the point where I was having suicidal thoughts, and I got close one evening to driving my car off the road. The thoughts were so strong. And I don't care if the thoughts are strong or not strong. You don't have thoughts of killing yourself or dying. That's not normal. No. Whatever range those thoughts are, it's not normal.
After that, did you go seek help?
No.
Did Mark know?
I did. I didn't seek the help of a psychiatrist or psychologist.
Okay.
And Mark did know that. We thought it could be depression.
Right.
And so I did see a regular family practitioner who prescribed me Prozac, which actually was wonderful. It made me feel great. But it made me gain weight. It made me feel lethargic. And after being a professional athlete and looking a certain way,
yeah.
I also felt like people were judging me that fit look that I had was gone, and that pressure to always keep that fit look was now, it was strong, and I wasn't fitting that mold anymore.
And so how long did you stop taking the medication then?
I was on the Prozac, gosh, for a few years.
Yeah.
Then just stopped. I talked to my doctor, told her I wanted to stop. And then basically, after I stopped, it was probably within 2 months that I changed again dramatically. And this time it seemed like things got even worse.
Changed in what way? Just more
thoughts were there.
Yeah.
Just this anxiety in me. I remember multiple times just trying to rock myself, maybe sitting on the floor, just trying to calm myself inside. And I couldn't do it. You know, I'd be crying. I usually kept this hidden from everybody, but it got to the point where it got bad again. And so I knew that I needed to get help. I knew this on my own because I'd already been on a drug. So I was prescribed Zoloft by another family practitioner who I just randomly called on the phone because I couldn't get in to see my doctor for 3 months because she was booked. But she was a family practitioner anyways. I was diagnosed this drug within 10 minutes. I was never asked by the doctor, do you have a history of mental illness in your family? You
know, he didn't even ask?
It was a woman.
Oh, she didn't ask, yeah.
He never
asked. Wow.
And you know, I don't know if that was because it's, you know, these are good doctors.
Of course.
You know, I just don't think maybe this particular clinic or, I don't know, wasn't educated on the right things to ask. Or is it they don't have enough time? They just have to get the patient in and get them out because they're so overwhelmed with people and not enough staff. I don't blame the doctor, but I see where that system needs to be improved.
Now, did your daughter Kylie see that mom is having some issues?
Because
kids are pretty,
absolutely.
Kids really understand that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She saw that her mom was having problems, no doubt.
And how did she deal with that?
You know, she's still so young at this time.
Yeah.
So, you know, her memory isn't so well about back in those days. You know, I talked to her about it, and she's like, no, I don't remember that, but I do remember this, Mom. So we have a lot of open communication about those days. Unlike me growing up, Kylie and me and Mark communicate about everything. So it's very healthy. But, yeah, of course, she saw some, you know, weird behavior in me. Why is Mom crying right now? Why is Mom sleeping right now? It's the middle of the day. You know, different things like that she saw.
So the new medication all of a sudden is...
I'm on fire. I'm feeling great.
Yeah, yeah. And then not just are you on fire, but you're also going, I want to try new stuff. I want to go jump out of an airplane. And for the 20th anniversary, you and Mark go to Vegas. And we're going to do a threesome. We're going to jump out of an airplane. We're going to do everything.
Bucket list. I remember hearing or reading some 80-year-old man was on his deathbed, and I remember him saying, God, there was just one more thing I wish I could have done was had a threesome in my life. And, you know, for some reason that stuck in my head thinking, that's what we need to do. We need to do that. Having no inhibitions whatsoever about it, just ready to pounce on this opportunity. It's going to be our secret. You know, people have these secrets within their private life,
sure.
Bedroom, and it's their private life, and that's great. But for me to act on it, I'm not sure. This is something I'll never know. Would I have been able to act on it without this being on this drug? I don't know, but I think looking back, maybe I would have been able to.
I just wonder if you were looking... You needed to replace the endorphins, the adrenaline that you got from, I mean, you're racing at an Olympic stadium with 85,000 people cheering. How do you replace something like that? That's a high that very few people get to experience.
Right. And life is changing here. Now I'm working a job that I cannot stand.
Right.
And clients are just unbelievable. This was when the house market was really crashing.
Right.
They were losing hundreds of thousands of dollars on their house, and they start blaming you as the realtor.
Right.
So I'm just getting crucified and by some of these people. It's my fault that your house didn't sell for $200,000 more. House sells for what it's going to sell for.
Right.
But they don't understand that, and you get to be the punching bag. And
you aren't ready to be a punching bag.
Yeah, and that's causing problems between Mark and I because I'm literally screwing up big time where we could get sued. I'm making mistakes that are really bad mistakes in the real estate.
Yeah.
And so that world of the threesome was like, wow, I'd never felt that alive and that on fire and that happy in my life besides, obviously, being with my daughter. That's the best time of my life, but I had this new awakening in me, and all of this is happening after I started that Zoloft, and this awakening, this feeling of being alive and energy like you wouldn't believe, and then suddenly something's happening in me where I'm not conscious of this. I'm just thinking this has always been in me. This is just who I am. But this hypersexuality is starting to develop. I didn't even know what the word hypersexuality meant. If somebody had told me that during that time, I'd be like, whatever, I'm just a sexual person.
Right.
So I didn't know what was happening. Again, I thought this was just me. And I'm changing. I'm looking for another high. The threesome was awesome. What could I do that would make this even better? And it's a process of 6 months of sexual exploration to, I believe, fill that void that was taken away from my running, my exercise, to give me this new high. But this high was incredible because I didn't have to train. I was the gold medalist every day.
Right.
And whether, and again, it started as the threesome. It went to me hiring a gigolo of my own because we had hired a woman for the threesome. So let's try it this other way. Let's up the ante to doing crazier and crazier things in that sex industry to then becoming an escort, which was going to be a one-time thing. But the one-time thing is incredible.
Yeah, you love it.
So now I've got to do it again, and I've got to continue on with this. And people don't, and I understand, people don't understand, how the hell does she go from being an Olympic runner to becoming an escort? And I want to educate people because there still is this shame, or people feel let down by what I did. They feel like I've let them down because I was this great runner. I was this role model, and I became the worst thing in the world in their minds, this escort. How did this happen? The reason it happened was I was ill, but yet me being ill doesn't make that industry awful and doesn't make the women who choose to do that industry awful people. It just wasn't a good thing for a woman who is bipolar, and risky things come with bipolar. It's one of the symptoms. Hypersexuality, risky behavior, endless energy, huge amounts of money spending. I mean, I spent $50,000 that year on I was going to swear. I don't know if we can.
No, that's okay.
I spent $50,000 on, I don't even know what I spent it on. Maybe it was designer shoes, designer purses, whatever. I walked by a store and saw something. Oh, I'll buy that, you know, $1,000, no problem. This is a part of the illness. It's all about how to make the mind feel good. And, you know, people need to look into, if they want to understand how I got from where I did to being an escort, educate yourself. Read about bipolar. Read about the symptoms. But I was hitting a double whammy. I was bipolar. All these symptoms come from just being bipolar. Now I'm given a drug on top of that that studies have shown in some people can bring on hypersexuality if you're bipolar. So now, double whammy.
Right.
Sex to me is completely normal. Getting paid for sex, sleeping with strangers, never once crossed my mind that I shouldn't be doing this. This is the best job in the world. This is way better than running any race.
And you have total control.
Total control.
Yeah, when the guy walks in, you are, they're going to do what you want them to do.
I am in charge.
Yeah.
100%. And I'm not in charge of just somebody. I'm in charge of this person who is so powerful.
Yep.
And is making huge decisions for huge companies in their life. And now Susie, little old me, is in control. This is awesome.
Well, and the other side of it, you started, obviously, you're Kelly, but you must have wanted to get discovered.
No.
You don't.
That is such a misconception.
Really? Because
I know, but that's a part of the illness.
Okay.
Where you do, and that's another part.
Because you're just being, you're taking,
reckless.
You're risky. You're just taking risks.
You're reckless.
Yeah.
You see, nothing, invincibility, nothing can touch you. Nobody's going to ever say anything about me.
Nobody will find out.
I mean, literally, I was already warned that this tabloid was onto me.
Yeah.
And at this point, you would think, oh, my God, get out.
Right.
Run for your life. Try and cover everything up. If you leave this, they're never going to find out. Erase all the websites. Never crossed my mind. I'm like, big deal. The guy has no proof. He's never going to find out.
And but meanwhile, some of the guys who you were with, they figured out who you were.
Yeah, because again, my recklessness.
Right.
I'm telling them.
You're telling them who I really am.
That's where people would say, "Oh, she totally wanted to get caught."
Yeah, that's what would be my thought. Is she must have wanted to get caught because she's telling them who she was. But that's part of the reckless behavior of I can tell them and it's still not going to go anywhere.
Right. And you know, recently a celebrity has just come out contracting
Charlie Sheen.
Yeah. You know, I'm not saying Charlie Sheen is bipolar, but he shows all the symptoms.
Reckless.
It's the reckless behavior.
Yeah.
The narcissism.
Yep.
It's the blaming others.
Oh, yeah.
Even blaming the escorts.
Right.
You know, taking no responsibility for yourself. That's part of the narcissism that comes because your thinking is so unclear. And that's where you consciously cannot make good decisions. And so you will do crazy things. I got into drugs, and oh my God, did I love drugs!
You mean like cocaine and things like that?
I was so close to cocaine, so close. It was on the table. I found ecstasy to be amazingly. People that take it, they love it. But with my bipolar, on top of that, my mania that I was in, it just heightened that to a level of. Where you're in a room and you're thinking, oh my God, could life get any better?
Yeah,
it can't because you're so high right now and you feel so incredible, and you're so lost in reality, and it's scary to think that I was there.
How did you deal as a mom when you came home after this?
You know, and Mark will say, you know, Susie was always a good mom during this period.
Yeah.
And I feel like I was an exceptional mom when I could come home, but I still struggled with the overwhelming feeling of having to be a realtor and being a good mom. I was still struggling with that. But Kylie, she just saw her loving mom who was starting to spoil her. I think that was a bit of the guilt I was feeling. And not seeing how spoiling a child can really hurt a child during that time.
The person who, I don't know how I would have dealt with this, when I look at Mark,
right.
And the fact that he was there, the fact that he stood by you through all this, was there a point where you thought, oh my God, I can't believe Mark is so amazing and is standing by me through all of this?
I think, you know, well, during that time, we were almost living two separate lives.
Right. Yeah.
So it's, you know, sometimes I think during that time I even thought about, okay, maybe we can buy two different houses. I loved him dearly during that time, believe it or not. I was never trying to hurt him. I was feeding my mania and what my brain thought. But I even thought, oh, we could just live in two separate houses and live great lives, and then our daughter's right there with both of us. And I love my husband, but maybe this would be better. It was bizarre thinking, but we were starting to go separate ways. And I think he thought I was gone, and he thought, well, we're going to get a divorce. We're right on track. This is going to happen. So there was a part of him that just gave up and surrendered. There's also that part of him and I now that look at sexuality completely differently. Meaning that we're not so uptight about this. And I think so many relationships can be saved, especially when it comes to mental illness. And, you know, with my behavior, I was never consciously trying to hurt him.
Right.
It was me feeding what my brain wanted. And maybe other people are we know lots of people are having affairs every day.
This sure.
is going on. He knew what I was doing. There was no lying involved. which is something we've told Kylie, you know, this was something, I wasn't cheating on your father. So she knows that, and that helps a child when there isn't lying involved. It helps a child to understand. But it was a crazy time, and I totally lost track of what my thought was going on this subject.
If Smoking Gun had not come, had not outed you, would you still be in this lifestyle?
I see myself as yes.
Because, yeah.
And I would have lost my husband.
Right.
Because I wouldn't have been on the right medication that I am now, which would, the medication I'm on now has stabilized me. The hypersexuality is gone. I mean, literally, it's gone. It took a while to get to that process where the drugs have really set in to help. And the drugs have taken away the risky behavior, the drug Lamictal that I'm on now. So I don't feel that way. I couldn't go back to that world because mentally I can't even get there.
Right. What was the toughest part of being outed? Were you targeted just with horrific names and emails and social media blasts?
I think the toughest was family.
Right, yeah.
You know, having to tell your parents and your parents-in-law who think you are the best person who's ever come into their son's life. You know, you are the golden girl.
Right.
Telling them and letting them down was devastating. I didn't know I was bipolar right away. Once they understood my bipolar, they understood how I got there, how I became the escort, why I did what I did. But in the beginning, they didn't understand at all, and I don't blame them because hypersexuality, bipolar, we don't talk about the hypersexuality component with this illness, so it is very shocking, very, very shocking that this could happen.
Susie, how cathartic was it for you to write the book, Fast Girl, A Life Spent Running from Madness? Because you'd think, so you spent a couple years just sort of disappearing a little bit. Was this helpful? It seems to me it would have been really helpful to write it, but then really scary to release it.
Yeah, you know, I think, well, I know that when I was outed, I was getting messages. I got a message from somebody who said, why don't you kill yourself just like your brother did?
Oh, my God.
Right? And then people, emails coming in, you're a whore, you're a slut, you're, you know, the worst person possible, you're going to hell.
Oh, my
God. All this stuff coming in it.
For somebody who's dealing with mental illness anyways, it's the last thing you need.
So now this is also helping to put me back in that suicidal state.
Right.
Which is just awful, But dealing with all this was incredibly difficult, but I felt I had to write the book to educate people, first of all.
Yeah.
Which they're struggling. People are still struggling to comprehend this, but that's because they aren't capable. They aren't capable of understanding because they don't want to understand, or maybe their religion is preventing them from understanding. There's so many factors on why people don't understand it. But the book explained why and how I got there. And there's even sections in the book that talk about bipolar that back up my behavior. My medical doctors, you know, understand this 100% because they deal with this all the time. And they're like, this is real. People need to read this book and realize this is real, a real illness. You know, if you ask people what hypersexuality is, maybe they don't know, but I can explain. It's where your thoughts in your mind are on sex constantly, nonstop.
That sounds like every guy who's ever been invented.
Yeah, but this is an extreme. I was more than any guy because I was on this path of not understanding why is my brain caught up in sex? Why has masturbation become such a big deal in my life where this was never, you know,
right.
a big deal. But that's a component. People don't even want to go there. Oh,
no.
My God.
No.
We're talking about masturbation. I can't believe that.
Yeah.
Where, let's face it, this happens all the time. We have a body. We want to explore our body. This is normal. But yet, it's taboo to even mention. When people are struggling with this every day, maybe not knowing why they're having this bizarre behavior.
When you finish the book, and I'm sure it's funny from dealing with, again, guys like Tyler Hamilton and the guys who wrote books who were dealing with the whole drug issues in cycling, what I'd hear from them was the easy thing is to say what part of what I did is really hard to, there was certain things you don't want to tell, but if you're doing a book, you have to tell everything.
Yeah, and that's hard. It's really hard because now you're opening up your entire life. It would have been easier, and I know a lot of people wanted me to just be quiet. Would she just vanish?
Yes.
Would she just, for God's
just
sake.
Just go away.
Go away. Why? Why talk about sex and all this stuff?
Yeah.
You know, what is her problem? Is she an attention seeker that she has to keep bringing this up? Well, you know what? I'm never going to stop talking about this because how is it going to help people if we can't talk about it? How can we get rid of the shame that's attached to it if we don't talk about it? So you know what? People that want me to go away and just shut up, it's not going to happen. You know, I'm here to stay and I'm here to talk about this. And if you don't want to hear it, oh my gosh, you have every right. We all have our own right. We have our own opinions, and that's fine.
Have you received, I'm sure, when the book came out and I'm sure you're nervous about the reaction and you got a lot of, I'm sure there was negative, but at the same time.
I wasn't too nervous about myself and what I talked about. I was more worried. The one thing that bothered me was family. Am
right.
I hurting?
Sure. Your daughter, your husband, your mom, your dad. Yeah, I'm
and
sure.
I knew with my husband and my daughter, I wasn't hurting them because
they lived it.
Yeah, they lived it, and Kylie understands the sex part of the book completely, 100%. She understands the component of the bipolar and the sex.
But I'm sure that you got some emails and calls and people reaching out saying thank you. Because I have been dealing with this, and you know, people don't understand, and people don't listen to me, and I don't feel I have a voice. I don't feel I have anywhere to go.
That just, it brings tears to my eyes because I've had emails, people telling me that I saved their life.
Wow.
I saw 2020. I just got one a couple of days ago. A transgender saying to me, transgender woman had said to me, saved my life. I saw you on 2020, and I was going to kill myself that day or that night. And you saved my life. And I've had other emails of people telling me I saved their life. And oh my God, okay, this has been totally worth it. As much as people have tried to humiliate me and bring me down further, I'm not going to let it happen because I know my story is real. I know my illness is real. I know that I can help people now. My public speaking is a new me. This is no longer Susie talking about her running in the glory days. This is bringing a topic to light and saving lives and doing a whole new purpose in life.
One of the things that happened in the last couple of years, and I've shared some of our videos from our Challenge Athletes Foundation and the athletes that we work with, and when Robin Williams passed, who was a very close friend of the foundation, and he actually had teamed up with this boy, Rudy Garcia Tolson, who's a double above knee amputee, and Rudy had been teamed up with Robin since he was 8 years old, and for 10 years they were teammates. And we were doing an interview for television here after Robin passed. And Rudy said something that's something you can relate to, is the reporter said, did you have a sense of Robin's depression? And Rudy said, my challenges are very visual. You can see what I'm dealing with. You can see my prosthetics. We didn't know what Robin was dealing with.
Yeah.
To me, that's exactly, people look at Susie Faber Hamilton. She's a runner. She's a mom. She's a daughter. They see you. They don't see the challenges because they're in your head, right? They're someplace that is not visual. So people think if it's not visual, then it's not real.
Right, exactly. We can't believe this.
Right. And that's probably the biggest thing that you're dealing with.
I think this analogy is hard for me because of 9/11, but I feel like this analogy can help people to understand that mindset of being in such a dark place where you will take your life. Is picture yourself in that burning building, and somebody with depression or extreme depression, that one of the one of the mood swings in bipolar is a very deep, dark depression. And picture yourself in this building, and you're hurting so much that the flames are approaching, and they're going to burn your body. And instead of feeling that pain, you jump. It's the same for bipolar. That pain is so great that if I stay on this earth, I'm going to burn. I would rather not burn. I would rather end it. And that, if people could understand how deep, dark that place is, they might understand why suicide, the rate is so high. It's unbelievable how many people die by suicide. If we can somehow reach out to these people.
If people knew they could talk about it, that would make a difference.
Right.
And people wouldn't look down on them for talking about it.
Right, and not shame them.
Yeah, when you say, I've contemplated suicide, people are concerned, but they're also scared, right? They're
right.
I don't know if I really want anything to do with this person.
They don't know what to say, too. Am I going
right.
to say thing? What about a hug? What about some love? You know, a simple hug can change somebody's day from taking their life.
So today, Susie, yoga, running hard, how do you replace those endorphins besides medication? What do you do to get that high that you need?
I've discovered it's called the bar method, or there's Pure Bar, but
yes.
It is the most amazing workout that I have found that I completely love, and it's brought this flexibility. I can do the splits. I never could do the splits.
Wow.
Fire light. And here I'm 47, and I'm doing these new things that I couldn't do. I'm hiking mountains. I just hiked Mount Baldy 2 weeks ago. I want to do Whitney soon, and I want to do Kilimanjaro, which is in the plans for my husband and I to do that either next year or the following year. Do adventure. Live life. And I think because my running world was so, I was so held in this bubble of constantly training, I was missing out on life, and now I have the opportunity to do so much more than just run. And, you know, I tell people, and they just don't get it. I'm like, listen, I run slow, and they all laugh. Oh, yeah, sure you do. And I'm like, oh, my God, will you guys just listen? I'm telling the truth. I run 9-minute miles, 9. And the other day I did 3 miles, and they were all 9-minute miles. And I'm like, after 3 miles, I'm like, done.
Plenty. I know. That's great.
And I'm running Carlsbad, the half marathon, for the Bipolar International Foundation.
Love that.
To help raise money. And I don't know if I'm going to be able to do the half. I'm going to do it, but it's going to be probably walk jog.
Well, we may have to have you run with our Running Elvis group and get you an Elvis outfit, and you can run really slow with us.
I am so there.
Oh, how fun is that?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll get you an Elvis outfit.
I'm all into the costumes now.
Yep.
Because it's just fun. Live life.
Exactly.
Who cares if you look ridiculous? I mean, really, come on. Have fun. Make memories.
So your daughter, Kylie, has a father who was a baseball player, a mom who was a world-class track athlete. Is she into sport? And if she is, is it something that you're concerned about with, gosh, I don't want her to go down that path of feeling that sport and performance is everything?
If anything, I'm definitely the parent who is like, you know, don't do that. If you're not having fun, don't do it. But, you know, she's in every sport. She just got into volleyball. And if you live in Southern California on the beach,
yep,
pretty much have to be a volleyball player.
Yes, you do.
Beach volleyball. So she's doing beach volleyball, soccer. She's on the swim team. You know, just she is an amazing athlete, I can see already. But she loves it. And she's also an amazing student. She didn't, thank goodness, she didn't get my attention deficit hyper disorder. So I'm so thankful for that she can study and blossom as a student also.
Is it hard for you to go to a swim meet and see some of the parents who are way out of control?
Oh, my God, it is so hard. I just want to go up and tell them, you know, okay, what you are doing is harming your child. Do you realize that you're doing this for yourself?
Right.
It's all about you. It's not about the child, so just back off. But I have no right. I have no right to tell this parent how to act, or just like nobody has any right to tell me how I should feel. And so much of society, when my story came out, tried to tell me how to feel and how I should be. And it hurt. And
right.
I'm not, from this point on now, it's not going to affect me.
I love it. Susie, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. It's always been a pleasure to interview you throughout the years. And just love the fact that you felt open enough to share this story. Because, like you said, if one person is moved to realize that suicide is not a good option, that I need professional help, and to change a life for the better, then everything you've gone through has been worthwhile.
Right. And it's so true. Unfortunately, people get to that place where their mind doesn't know right from wrong, and suicide becomes the only option. And we have to get to a place where we can help these people before their brain gets so chemically imbalanced that they can't see right from wrong.
Love it.
And speaking out, but I have to say, Bob, your interview is so different than all the other interviews I've done, because you've just, I swear to God, all the questions you ask have been so different from what I've been asked. And the way you have laid it out, I mean, truly enjoyed doing this interview with you. And, you know, that speaks highly of the person who is interviewing you, because I've learned through this process, I'll get off a phone interview and go, oh, my gosh, that was just not good. Because the interviewer is the key.
Well, the key is that you have an amazing story. You have an amazing background. And you never want to look at what somebody is dealing with. Again, going back to the not being able to see what somebody's challenges are. We've been through our Challenge Athlete Foundation dealing with the parents of children with disabilities, dealing with troops coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, missing legs, so you can see that, but you don't know about the PTSD that they're dealing with. So you can never discount what somebody's going through. It's real. And people need to understand that. And I appreciate you coming forward and being brave enough to tell your story. And to be honest, I've always enjoyed you as a person. Just over the years, we've done a couple of different interviews, and I've just found you to be incredibly honest and upfront about everything you're dealing with. So,
thank you. And you are so right. Could we, as a society, stop judging and be more compassionate and understanding before you make that remark about somebody? You know, really think about, why do I even need to make that remark? Why am I judging? What good is coming from this?
Exactly. Exactly.
Gosh, if we could all be like that, we would be so much happier. That's my wish for today, is that everybody who's listening to this will not be judgmental and show compassion and be more loving towards each other and maybe do some good deed today.
You are the best. Susie Faber Hamilton has been our guest. Again, we are brought to you by Ironman U. Run Catalina.com, the Catalina Island Conservancy Marathon coming up on Saturday, March 19th. Susie, you can do that. It's all off-road, about 4,000 feet of climbing. You can hike. You see buffalo. You see wild boar. You would love that.
How far is it?
Well, there's a marathon and there's a half marathon.
Oh, my God, I would love to do the half marathon.
We will make that happen.
Send me the info. I am so there.
Everysite.com. Our Challenge Athletes Foundation, we've raised over $70 million to keep athletes in the game of life through sport. And one of these days, Susie, we'll get you to San Diego and see our amazing CAF building. It's pretty special.
Well, I'm coming next week
for a
luncheon. Yeah.
Let me know. We'll do a quick tour. You will love it. It's amazing.
Okay.
And we check out any of our interviews on babbittville.com or on iTunes. Hold on, everyone. We will be right back.